for argument, Knox versus United States. Ms. Barry.
May it please the court, Kathleen Barry for the appellant, Sammy Knox. In this appeal from the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief, Mr. Knox respectfully
requests... Could you raise your voice some?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not raise the microphone, raise your voice.
Sorry, Your Honor. In this appeal from the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief, Mr. Knox respectfully requests that the court vacate his sentence and remand his case for resentencing because he was prejudiced by his counsel's deficient performance in failing to raise the argument at issue in this case at sentencing or on direct appeal. Specifically, counsel failed to argue that when the jury returns a general verdict on a multiple object conspiracy case, it is impossible to determine which object of the conspiracy the jury convicted the defendant of. Accordingly, the sentencing court must assume that
given the fact that we have already held that any Apprendi problem was harmless, what's left?
Your Honor, respectfully, the issue in this case is not an Apprendi problem. The question is not...
It's just a different language to describe what is functionally the same problem. Your complaint is that the jury did not make a particular finding beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what Apprendi is all about. And that's sort of what Booker is all about, except Booker ended in a conclusion that the findings would be made by the judge on the preponderance standard after all.
Again, respectfully, Your Honor, the jury in this case was properly instructed and did return a proper jury verdict as to all of the elements of the conspiracy to distribute teas and blues. And unlike the Apprendi error, which was addressed by this court, in that case the court analyzed whether the jury in this case had returned a proper verdict as to if it had been properly instructed, whether it would have returned a verdict to support a life sentence on cocaine. In other words, whether or not it was possible for the jury to determine that there was sufficient quantity of cocaine to support the sentence. The court never considered whether it was possible that the jury had only convicted Mr. Knox of a conspiracy to distribute teas and blues. And that, unlike the Apprendi error, is not subject to harmless error analysis.
But why shouldn't it be subject to harmless error analysis?
Because, as the Supreme Court explained in Edwards, when there is a difference between the statutory maximum sentences, as there was in Orozco Prada, and as there is in this case between teas and blues and cocaine, the sentence makes a difference. The error makes a difference.
Well, any error that affects the sentence makes a difference. I don't understand you.
Well,
all the defendant cares about the length of the sentence. So I don't understand this category.
The difference between an Orozco Prada error and an Apprendi error is an Apprendi error occurs in the instructing of the jury at trial. The Orozco Prada error occurs at sentencing.
I know. So why should that make a difference?
It makes a big difference because...
I must say, there's no such thing as an Apprendi error that occurs in the jury instructions. The error occurs at sentencing when the judge imposes a sentence given the fact that the jury had not found certain facts. There's nothing about Apprendi that ever requires any jury to be instructed about anything. It's simply a rule about what sentences are available given what the jury found.
Your Honor, Apprendi makes it makes all of the sentencing factors elements of the crime that the jury must find.
No, it does not make them elements. An element is something in which if you don't do it, you're not guilty. The Supreme Court held in Cotton that Apprendi did not change the elements of any offense. It's procedural, not substantive.
It repeated
that in Schraro against Summerlin just last term. You're going to get nowhere with a claim that Apprendi changed the elements of any offense.
Apprendi made it as an element of the offense.
No, it did not. That's the very argument that Cotton rejected.
Respectfully, Your Honor, in Cotton, the court was considering whether the Apprendi error was plain error and didn't consider whether or not the jury had potentially
That was the
found
second question in Cotton. The first question in Cotton was whether it required reversal because Apprendi altered the elements of the federal drug offense and thus the propriety of the indictment. The first part of Cotton said no, it didn't change the elements. Second part says, and it wasn't plain error either. But if your argument turns on this, I think you're in trouble.
Where are you going? That's what I understand. So this category of structural errors, what's that about? What's the reason for it? Why should it embrace this particular error?
Well, it's a structural error because it is an error that occurs at sentencing by the court.
Please. The many errors occur at sentencing, and they're not structural errors. So you have to have some concept of what this category is for. Why there is such a category? Why isn't everything subject to harmless error?
Well, it's because the court is at sentencing is required to pick the appropriate statute to apply to the jury's conviction. And in this case, the court chooses the wrong statute to apply to the sentencing. And it chooses a statute that it has no reason
to. But you might be convicted under a statute you hadn't violated. That wouldn't be a structural error, right?
If you were convicted under a statute that you hadn't violated?
Right. It'd just be a mistake. You're innocent, but you're convicted. That happens once in a while. Right?
Yes, that would be possible. But in this case, the question is whether or not possibly Mr. Knox was just convicted of a conspiracy involving T's and Blues or some other drug with a lower statutory maximum sentence. And it is possible that he was convicted of that.
That would be true whenever there was an error in the instructions, right? Or not whenever, but very often if the instruction were erroneous, the jury might convict him of something he clearly hadn't committed.
That's possible, but again, the error...
Why is that a less serious error than what happened here?
Because if it's an error that occurs at trial, we can look at what the evidence was that was presented to the jury and whether or not...
Yeah, what if there wasn't enough evidence? And there was, you know...
That's a question, then. If there's not a sufficient evidence, that's a question then on appeal for whether or not there was a sufficient evidence. But here, Mr. Knox didn't even have the chance to make the argument because his counsel did not raise the argument at sentencing or on direct appeal that he was possibly only convicted of a conspiracy involving T's and Blues. That's what counsel
should
have done.
What if someone is charged with burglary and the instruction says, burglary means failing to take your hat off in a church? And he appeals, says he's not guilty of burglary, but the court says, well, actually, although, you know, that's what the instruction was, there's really ample evidence that you broke into this house and took things. Now, why would that be somehow a less grave error than what occurred here?
I don't know that it... The jury, when a jury is improperly instructed, the court has said that we can go back and look and see whether or not there was sufficient evidence that
right.
If
so
a
we
properly
can do that here
jury.
Too, right?
But
what's the difference?
The difference is that the jury was properly instructed. The jury verdict was we're not disputing the jury verdict. There's nothing wrong with the jury verdict. The question is, what does the jury verdict mean, and what can the sentencing court, what sentencing statute can the sentencing court apply to this jury verdict? And the only
But if you have a misinstructed jury, but there's still evidence, for all you know, the person wasn't meaningfully convicted. The jury may have been totally muddled. Nevertheless, the verdict is sustained. So,
but we presume...
Why is that worse than what happened here?
Well,
don't start presuming things either.
Well, the presumption is that
the
jury...
Let's keep it on a plane of reality. If the jury is seriously misinstructed, there's no presumption that they did anything right.
But they weren't misinstructed here.
I know, but if they were misinstructed, you agree that would be harmless error. This somehow for you is not harmless error. So why?
It's not harmless error because it's...
I mean, why is it not subject to harmless error? Why is it a different kind of mistake?
Or I could ask the question a different way. Cotton says Apprendi errors are subject to plain error analysis. Booker says that Booker errors are subject to plain error analysis. What is it about this variant that would make it not subject to plain error analysis when those two variants are?
Because unlike those variants, this is an error that occurs afterwards at sentencing. It's the wrong application of the sentencing
statute.
But
that's exactly what Apprendi and Booker are. They have to do with what is the right sentence given what the jury found.
But respectfully, Your Honor, in this case, we don't know exactly what the jury found.
No, we know exactly what the jury found. We don't know what the jury would have found had it been given different instructions, but we know exactly what the jury found.
Right. The jury found that it was a narcotics conspiracy. Whether that was a narcotics...
So the question is, what is a permissible sentence given what the jury actually did? And that's the basis for my question. You know, Apprendi says... Cotton says plain error analysis. Booker says plain error analysis. Why would this be some kind of automatic reversal with no plain error analysis? That's my puzzle.
It's not plain error because it's the application of the correct statute, and court hasn't applied the correct statute in this case.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Barry. Mr. Bindi?
May it please the Court, David Bindi on behalf of the United States.
Mr. Bindi, I want to just ask you something at the risk of sounding, you know, like a simpleton. Even if the evidence was overwhelming as to an agreement to distribute heroin, or for that matter, every single drug that was alleged, the jury was instructed that it need only agree as to one of the drugs, right?
That's correct.
So it's possible that the jury agreed as to the T's and blues and stopped there, right?
That is possible, Your Honor.
In other words, nothing compelled the jury to make a decision as to each of the drugs, right?
That is true.
In other words, we can't simply assume that the jurors agreed on heroin without usurping the jury's role, can we?
It's true that we cannot assume anything about what the jury found, but that's not the question, and it never has been. Starting from the point, from the standpoint that the error that occurred here is not structural error, the question then becomes whether a properly instructed jury would have made the findings that support the sentence. It's not about divining what the actual trial jury actually did, because that's impossible. That can never be done. When the jury wasn't requested to make a particular finding, when it wasn't required to make a particular finding, then what it might have thought about the evidence is simply not the question. I think the Supreme Court has made perfectly clear that when you're engaged in harmless error or plain error analysis, that's not the question. The question is whether the evidence is so overwhelming that a reviewing court can state with confidence that had the jury been properly instructed, it would have made the finding that supports the sentence. And that is, in fact, the conclusion that this court reached on remand from the Supreme Court on direct appeal.
See, let me tell you where I'm having a bit of a problem. Where Apprendi errors are concerned, we're predicting what the jury would have found had the matter of the drug amount been submitted to the jury, right?
That's correct.
But where Orozco Prada errors are concerned, it isn't a question of predicting what a jury would have done, right? Because the jury, in this case, did make a finding as to which drug or drugs the defendants conspired to distribute. But because its verdict was a general verdict, we can never know which drugs the jury agreed on. In other words, even if the evidence was overwhelming as to the distribution of heroin or even as to all of the drugs, the jury's instructed, again, I say, that it only had to agree on one drug. And we, for all we know, once it agreed on one, it stopped there. And we don't have a way of piercing the verdict to figure which drugs it selected. So it does seem to be a Stromberg type of case.
No, Your Honor. Stromberg no. doesn't come into play here at all, because Stromberg involved a situation where in a multiple object conspiracy, one of the objects that was submitted to the jury was something that the defendant could not legally be punished for because it was constitutionally protected behavior. So there you're talking about a difference between a possibility of a verdict that could not have supported any punishment at all, as opposed to, in this situation, the return of a verdict that supports punishment, but the question then becomes, what's going to be the basis for the imposition of sentence?
Well, let me ask you this. Had the Orozco product claim been argued on direct appeal, do you think it's reasonably likely that we might have granted him relief?
No, I don't think so, because at the time that this court heard the direct appeal initially, before the remand from the Supreme Court, in the Edwards opinion, this court had explicitly rejected Orozco Prado. So,
but then the Supreme Court in Edwards noted the distinction between the lack of a jury finding as to drug amount and an Orozco Prada error.
Well, they made note of the decision in Orozco Prada. It's a CF site in dicta.
Yeah.
The argument has been made here that constituted an adoption by the Supreme Court of the rule of Orozco Prada. That argument is, to say the very least, a big, big stretch. If the Supreme Court had actually believed it had done that, you would think that they would have made some mention of Edwards in deciding cases like United States versus Cotton. Edwards, to my knowledge, was not, as a matter of fact, I think I took a look at this recently. Edwards isn't mentioned in the Cotton opinion, and it's not even mentioned in any of the parties' briefs. So I think that to argue that the Supreme Court adopted such a drastic rule with a CF site in dicta going on 7 years ago now.
In the course of affirming a decision.
Exactly.
That expressly rejected that case.
As I stood up here, I felt that I really had nothing further to add to the discussion today, unless there were questions. Your Honor, I hope I've answered your questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bindi.
Thank
Ms. Barry, how much time? Well, you can have a minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just add that in Edwards, the Supreme Court did approve Orozco Prada.
It's a little tough to say. The reason certiorari was granted in Edwards was to resolve a conflict between this circuit and the Second Circuit. We took one view of things. Orozco Prada took a different view of things. Mm-hmm. And our judgment was affirmed. To say that that approves the Second Circuit's view of things is pretty tough, isn't it?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court specifically noted the distinction between the case that this court addressed in Edwards, the facts of Edwards, and the facts of Orozco Prada. It noted that if
the
there was a difference...
The facts were certainly different. They were reserving the issue that turned out to be Apprendi. Edwards is the year before Apprendi. They are busily having this fight. They were having it at the time of Almendarez-Torres, which was the same term as Edwards.
Your Honor, again, the argument is that it was the difference between whether the jury was properly instructed and whether the jury verdict itself, a complete thing, which is what it is in Orozco Prada and what it was in this case as to T's and Blues, can support a life sentence, and it just can't.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Ms. Barry? Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you to Mr. Bindi. And court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.